I guess before I start relating what happened in the last trip to Vietnam, I should talk a little bit about myself and my first trip to Vietnam and my prior history to that. I had 12 years of Catholic education prior to going in the service. My senior year of high school, I was president of the Junior Republicans. My freshman year at college, my first semester, I was a member of Young Americans for Freedom. And I enlisted in the service right from that. Enlisted in the Army. I went to OCS in the age of 19. I became a commissioned officer in the infantry. Spent 10 months in Vietnam with the AmeriCal Division as an infantry platoon leader in a battalion S2. Returned to the United States. Spent 8 more months in the service and then got out. When I got back to the United States, I had to reevaluate everything that I'd seen in Vietnam, everything that I'd done in Vietnam. And I had to face the contradictions that I'd seen there. Prior to going into the military, I'd believed that the U.S. was right, that the communists were invading the South, that they were committing atrocities. But after I came back and I started thinking about the things I'd seen and the things I'd done, I'd realized that the United States Armed Forces was the enemy, and the Vietnamese people were the good guys. As a consequence, when I got out of the service, I got involved in campus politics, then GI organizing. About 2 years ago, involved with VVAW. In December, the Vietnamese invited the four people that Gary just mentioned to go to Hanoi with the supposed specific purpose of taking letters to the POWs and returning with letters from the POWs for their families. When we originally left, we had no idea that Nixon was going to launch the massive bombings against Hanoi and Haiphong that he did launch. We arrived in Vietnam on the 16th of December. The first 2 days were spent meeting government officials, seeing some general tourist sites, and even going to mass. But on the third day, things started to change. That was the day that Nixon began the bombing of Vietnam. The bombing continued for the next 10 days until we left Vietnam. During that time, there was approximately 60 strikes against the city of Hanoi itself. One of the first things that we were shown after the bombing was started was this first civilian area that had been totally and completely destroyed. What this area looked like was first an area approximately a mile by half a mile. It was a civilian area, and it looked like somebody had gone in with a plow and a bulldozer and completely knocked all the buildings down. The only thing that you could tell that it was bombed was the fact that it was totally pockmarked with 500, 750-pound bombs. While we were standing there, a Vietnamese woman who saw us noticed that we were Americans, because it's kind of hard to hide the fact that you're Americans. There's a distinctive look about us. Came over to us. She pointed to a great big bomb crater, smiled and said, "Nixon's peace," got on her bicycle and drove away. 2 days later, we visited the POW compound. When we got there, we were in for a shock, and that was because there were holes in the roofs, and the whole camp was full of shrapnel. And when that civilian area had been bombed, the concussion and the shrapnel from the civilian area had had damaged the POW compound itself. We met with approximately 13 POWs in three groups and talked to them for about an hour and a half. What was strange was one of the POWs from Texas kept pointing to the sky and asking us, "What's going on here? What's happening? I thought the war was supposed to have ended in October." There was nothing I could answer except say, "Well, I think a lot of Americans thought the same way." We had a look about him, and they were all confused, and they just couldn't understand why Americans were dropping bombs on them as well as the Vietnamese. And the only thing they could say was, "Would you go back and tell him to stop?" The next day, we visited Bac Mai Hospital. We were told by the Vietnamese, that we were there approximately 12 hours after the airstrike, the second airstrike against the hospital. Bac Mai was the largest hospital in North Vietnam. It had approximately 920 beds. It had many of the internal machines that are used in Vietnam, one-of-a-kind machines the Vietnamese had. It's also where they did experiments. Bac Mai wasn't built like American hospitals are built up. It was built out. There was a main administration building that was probably three stories high, another building that was three stories, and the rest were just one- and two-story complexes, and they stretched out over an area of maybe 200 meters, 300 square meters, very vast area. And the area was literally leveled. The three-story buildings were cut in half. There was debris everywhere. The patients that had been wounded and the medical workers that had been wounded were being carried out on people's backs. But the director of the hospital, who was semi-smiling, semi-crying, said that because of the early warning system, all the medical attendants had been able to get all of the patients to the shelters, and not one single patient had died. But he said sorrowfully that 20 of the medical attendants were now buried alive, and they were trying to dig them out, and six of the other attendants were killed. We later found out that those 20 people were never recovered, because the Americans went in the next day and bombed it again, which stopped rescue operations. And besides that, dropped delayed fuse bombs, which meant that as the repair work and the recovery work was going on, these bombs were exploding. After this period of time, we consistently went through more and more areas, constantly seeing bombed out areas. Everything we saw was precision bombing. Heard a lot about the fact that they're mistakes or they're military targets, but it's totally absurd. You'd walk down the streets of Hanoi, and there'd be no damage, and all of a sudden you'd come across a wasteland. There'd be 3, 4, 5 square blocks completely destroyed, completely knocked down. Then you'd walk on, and there'd be no more damage. The bombing patterns themselves were very tight. They weren't spread out. And after the areas were destroyed, they were usually hit 2 and 3 and 4 more times with a phantom raid. So if a B-52 came in and carpet bombed, the phantoms would go in and hit the rescue people. Now, people can say that you may make a mistake with 1 or 2 bomb, or even that you may make a mistake with 1 bombing raid. But the U.S. government can't claim that it makes that mistake over and over and over again. And it can't claim that it makes a mistake when the accuracy is so good that bombs are falling in the same craters of the previous attacks. When we went, the final area that we visited that was bombed out was a very crowded old residential area. And this was on the other side of the POW compound that we visited. And this was for the first time the Vietnamese allowed us to see bodies, wounded people, and real destruction. Up until this time, the Vietnamese refused to show us these sort of things, even though they showed news reporters from other countries. As we walked through that area, we saw people crying. One woman leaning over a destroyed house, saying in sort of a song, my son, where are you, my son? But it's not enough to talk about the destruction and the sadness. We also have to talk about the bravery, the kindness, the determination, and the strength of the Vietnamese people. Because while this was going on, they were continuing with the struggle. We'd go into an area and we'd see people crying. But in the morning, the Vietnamese would be on their bicycles at 5:30, a rifle slung over their shoulder, going to work, smiling, talking, and waving. It's also, pardon me, this is my fourth speech today, and I'm getting sort of mixed up, and besides getting emotional. The Vietnamese, in their kindness towards us, refused to allow us to see either dead Americans or downed B-52s or phantoms. One of the members of the delegation asked to see downed planes, and the head of the Vietnamese Solidarity Committee with the American people said every people must have their pride. And it will do you Americans pride no good to see your plane shot down or to see your pilots killed. That also speaks to their kindness and consideration. The other thing is that the Vietnamese people probably have the highest political consciousness of any people in the world. They make a real and absolute distinction between the United States government and the American people. They look upon the American people as their friends. They look upon the Americans as being duped by Nixon. into the present policy. They believe that the Americans want peace. And this is carried over to the prisoners that they themselves capture. At Bakmai Hospital on the third raid, a pilot was shot down, and he fell over the ruins of the hospital. And as he came down over the ruins, he broke his leg. He was captured by a nurse. And the nurse told him, not facetiously, but in all sincerity, "I'm sorry we can't fix your leg here, but the hospital's been destroyed, and we have to take you to the underground hospital, and it'll be at about an hour." And this continued all the while we were there. For 13 days, the four of us, four Americans, wandered the cities of Hanoi, visiting bombed-out shelter, or bombed-out sites, bombed-out hospitals, bombed-out civilian areas, bombed-out nurseries. And we didn't have one bad reaction from any Vietnamese there. They never referred to us as the enemy, as the former enemy. They only referred to us as brother and sister and as friend. And as far as being just shown certain specific sites, it's true that the Vietnamese took us to bombed-out civilian areas and bombed-out hospitals. But they took us to only one or two sites a day. And the rest of the time was ours. And we used to go for walks without our interpreters and without our guides back to those same areas that we'd visited, back to those same areas that had been bombed. So it wasn't a matter of the Vietnamese putting a show up for us unless there's 200,000 actors in Hanoi and no people. And finally, before I get into questions, because I hope people have a lot of questions, I'll have to speak about, gotta really apologize, I'm just really losing it. Finally, that we've been taught all our lives that Oriental people put face above human life. The strange thing that I saw when I was in Vietnam was that wasn't true of the Vietnamese. As a matter of fact, it's completely turned around. The Americans are bombing the Vietnamese, are losing Americans, are killing people because face is more important. And they would rather lose human lives than admit a defeat. When we'd wander through the bombed out areas, we went through one area in which the people were singing and laughing and joking. And the area was totally and completely destroyed. We were very confused, and we asked our interpreter, "Why are these people so happy?" And he said, "Well, the biggest reason is that nobody was hurt here. Nobody lost any of their friends. Nobody lost any members of their family. And although they had lost everything they had owned, the only thing that was important was that members of their family hadn't been lost, that friends hadn't been lost." If you try to evaluate that or look at American way of life, think about when you put a $50 dent in your car in an accident, whether you think about whether someone was hurt or whether you think about fixing that dent in your car. So please, if people would ask questions, it'd probably be a little easier on me right now. Well, the Vietnamese Committee of Solidarity with the American People is made up of the people that invite Americans to their country. It's also the group that keeps close contact with the U.S. peace movement, that monitors what's going on in the United States. The awareness of the peace movement by the Vietnamese was unbelievable. Everything that happens in the United States is printed in their papers. Everything. I knew on Christmas Day that the vets had had an action in New York because it was printed in the Hanoi newspaper. I knew that someone had been beat up in New York because it was printed in the Hanoi newspaper. They also provide the interpreters, the guides, etc., that take care of us. One thing the Vietnamese consistently talked about, and that was their heritage of struggle. They were very proud of the fact that they were the only people to ever defeat Genghis Khan. And along with that, they were also proud that they said that after they had defeated Genghis Khan, they returned the horses and the arms to the defeated army and told them to leave. They were proud of the fact that they'd fought the Chinese for 1,000 years, the French for 100 years, the Japanese for 6, and the Americans for, the past 20 years. And they talked about the fact that they would fight for the next 200 years, if necessary, for freedom and independence. And they told me, they said, "You know, most of our cities have been destroyed. Maybe we'll have to lose Haiphong and Hanoi, but it doesn't matter. The important thing is independence and freedom." Basically, that's what it comes out of. comes out of a history of struggle, and it comes out of a present political consciousness that I believe is unmatched in the world. And that consciousness reads out in their ability to differentiate between a pilot that bombs them and the people that send that pilot over to do the bombing. And it reads out in the way they look at material things. More questions? Well, first off, they're one people. I mean, if you mean how do the Vietnamese look upon the Vietnamese in the South, some of the people who were in the Vietnam Committee were Southerners. Some of the people were Northerners. If you mean how do they look upon the Thu regime, they look upon it as a puppet of the United States government. Well, they're one people. I mean, I guess it would be like how you'd look at somebody in Dayton coming from, I guess this is Yellow Springs. The Vietnamese have one culture, they have one language, they're one people. That's the other thing they constantly emphasize to us. You know, it was really surprising to me. After spending a year in the South, where I saw this cheap carbon copy of an American culture, where I saw a culture completely raped, where I saw women that had to have their eyes fixed and have silicone put in their breasts so that they'd look more American, where I saw Pepsi-Cola signs, where I saw Bear aspirin signs, to go to a country like North Vietnam, where they had a Vietnamese culture, where they drank Vietnamese beer, where they spoke Vietnamese, where the architecture was Vietnamese, where everything was Vietnamese. It wasn't a carbon copy of the United States or Japan. And it was really strange. Well, even prior to the bombing, we were told that 80% of the population had been evacuated. After the bombing started, they evacuated even more, leaving only the essential personnel. One of the problems came down that the plane started to bomb the roads as the evacuations were going on, and that forced refugees back into the city. What, military targets? When we first entered Vietnam, when we drove from the airport to the city itself, we passed a train station, an area where they repaired old cars and worked on engines. And that area was nice and neatly bombed. There was only a few bombs outside of the train area. That was a military area. Of course, that was hit before this newest bombing. Also, I might say that when we tried to leave Vietnam the second time, we passed that area, and that whole area had been carpet bombed, and they destroyed the whole civilian area surrounding it, even though that had been destroyed before. The airport, the main terminal, had been destroyed, and the workers' quarters had been destroyed. The strange thing was there was only one or two bomb craters in the airstrip itself. The airstrip wasn't the target. It was the workers' quarters and the main terminal. That's the whole thing about the bombing in that 10 days that we were there. It was terrorism. It wasn't geared towards military targets. We used to go back and forth over two pontoon bridges that connect Hanoi, which is built on a delta, with the, quote, mainland. Those pontoon bridges were never hit. The National Assembly was never hit. The Presidential Palace was never hit. May Day Square was never hit. The National Bank was never hit. Foreign Affairs Office was never hit. Go ahead. Well, we didn't visit the Hanoi Hilton. We drove past the Hanoi Hilton. The POW compound that we visited was halfway between the city and the suburbs. The Hanoi Hilton might have been hit. One civilian area that we went through, the one where I told you the people were singing because they hadn't lost any lives, was 30 feet from that area. It was just across the street. When that civilian area was hit, the Cuban embassy was hit also. The windows were blown out. The plaster was knocked out. I believe while we were there, the Polish embassy, the Cuban embassy, the Hungarian embassy was hit. As a matter of fact, every socialist embassy had been hit, except the Soviet embassy wasn't hit. Joan Baez was fantastic, you know. And It was really strange. The first 3 days, we argued a lot. I'm not a pacifist. I was a pacifist about 4 years ago for a week. I got involved in student politics, got beat, and went back to being a crazy. But she was really good. The first thing was that the only songs she sang in Vietnam were old civil rights songs and freedom songs. That's the first thing. She had a very good relationship with the Vietnamese people. They loved her. Every place she went, she sang. And I had 2, 3, 4, 5 concerts a day, going all the way from early morning all the way into the night. My prime story, which I usually save for the end, but which I'll tell you now because it's great, was that on the last night that we were there, we were on the third floor of the hotel where we were staying, the Hoa Binh, which was only one block from the Algerian embassy, which had been bombed, and was right across the street from a strategic site, a pencil factory. And we were sitting on the third floor reading the news reports because that was where Agence France-Presse was located, which is the UPI or the AP of France. And the lights went off, the siren came on, and the bombing started. And I said, well, do you want to go down to the shelter? And she says, not this time. I'm going to stay up. Then she walked out on the balcony. There was no lights. It was a nice, clear, brisk night with a nice breeze blowing. And she started singing to the city of Hanoi during the whole alert. She sang some really good old civil rights songs. And as she would sing the songs, Carrie, and the people that were in those small two-people shelters that just dot the roads, they're like foxholes, started clapping. And she started singing a really good old civil rights song, old freedom song, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around, Marching Off to Freedom Land. And she started singing with verses, Ain't Gonna Let No Nixon Turn Me Around, Ain't Gonna Let No Bombing Turn Me Around. And she would alternate between Marching Off to Freedom Land and Marching Off to Vietnam. And just as she reached the last line, the lights came on, the all-clear siren sounded, and the Vietnamese gathered below the balcony, and she ended with, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around, Marching Off to Freedom Land, and the people went crazy. They were applauding. It was, everybody was crying. They were crying, she was crying, I was crying. It was really good. Also, on the last day, when we left, we were only able to get out because the Chinese kept their airline going, and that was the only air contact with Vietnam. But when we were leaving, we left on a plane with the Polish sailors that had survived the attack on the Polish ship in Haiphong, and they were burned, wounded, and really shell-shot very bad. And after the Chinese plane landed, there was an air raid. We had to go down to the shelters. And she looked around and she saw how bad off they were. And she started singing lullabies that she'd written for her son Gabriel and stroking people's heads. And they started to cry and she started to cry and everyone else started to cry, which was probably the best thing could happen to a person when he's shell-shot. And we got outside. And when we initially came into country, Joan had said, well, you know, what do you want to see? And I said, well, of course I want to see an anti-aircraft gun and I want to see the militia units. And she said, well, I'm not going to sing for any soldiers. I'm not going to do a USO show. And we got upstairs and I said, you know, you just put on a USO show. And she just started to cry even more. And the Polish sailors just came up and asked for her autograph because she'd done a free concert in Poland and had been put on national television. They all knew who she was. And that generally speaks for her attitude. Very good. Very good. Again, I'm not a pacifist.
There was a lot of talk about bombing the dikes in the late summer and in the fall. And I was wondering what the effect of that has been, whether we never heard much about that beyond like projections of dikes breaking.
One thing that the Vietnamese said was that this year there was a very low rainfall. And luckily for them, as a consequence, only a few of the dikes gave way and that they were busy trying to reinforce all the dikes. And hopefully they'd be able to have them repaired before the next rainfall. One thing that the bombing of those dikes and that did not affect the food supply in Hanoi. While we were there, the open-air markets were full of fresh fruits, fresh vegetables. The only thing I didn't see while I was in Hanoi was dairy products. And all this food wasn't going to rich tourists. It was all going to the people because there wasn't any tourists there. Is there any other question? Right up there.
Brit-
Richard Nixon. Well, see, the basic thing that they said was that they would not go back on any of their basic principles. They would not, and that meant the original seven-point program that was there a long time ago. They emphasized the fact about the political prisoners in the South. They emphasized the fact of U.S. withdrawal. And they also talked about the fact about the release of our POWs in return for it. The stumbling block was Richard Nixon's signature. They just simply came out and said that they were not going to sign away any of their basic interests. No, those two-man shelters are no escape against the B-52 strike. Some of the other underground shelters might be if you could get dug out. That's the whole terrorist aspect about that kind of bombing. It's not sporadic, and that's the whole thing about it being geared towards civilian areas. You know, you're sitting in a shelter, and you run down to a shelter five, six, seven times a day, and you're sitting down there, and all of a sudden you realize there's an area that's just totally and completely being churned. You're not sure whether your area is going to be hit next, whether your area is going to be hit right then. And those type of shelters against B-52 raids don't offer much protection unless they're dug down into the ground very deep. And if there's a direct hit on that, then it's all over also. Well, the people that shared our shelter with us were members of the ICC Commission. That's the International Control Commission. Those are the people that are supervising the 1954 Geneva peace agreements. I really don't know. The only thing I can say is that it's important that peace treaty is signed, and but more important that it be implemented. And that means that the United States peace movement, anti-imperialist movement, revolutionary movement, whatever we are, it's important that for the first time we actually seize upon something and we complete a job. And that means that once that peace treaty is signed, we have to push for the implementation. And that's one thing the Vietnamese brought up also. They said that the only thing the treaty means is a different form of struggle, that implementation is the next step. And as far as what's really going on with this present thing, I don't know. You know, for 4 years, Nixon used Agnew as his front man. He used him pretty good. Then he had a latest peace treaty, and he found a new front man, too. He used him for a while. And the latest, quote, peace accords might be nothing more than something to diffuse the peace movement at this time. I don't know. Maybe Kissinger's going to come back and say there's another stumbling block. Maybe two is. Maybe Richard Nixon himself's going to say it. Maybe they're going to sign the treaty and try to sneak in the back door. I'm not sure. I know that I don't trust him. I know that I haven't for about 4 years, but... That's all I can say. More questions?
You know what's happening with the weather? Like,
say again?
About the weather. Like they changed the weather pattern so they might be in the cloud. And it does that have an effect on like less rainfall this year?
I don't have the slightest idea. Don't have the slightest. I'm sorry. As I said before, I'm not a pacifist, but, you know, I sat down in the shelter after arguing for about 5 days with Joan about such important matters. And one thing that I discovered, and that was that I really wasn't judging who the enemy was and who the friends were. And I realized that the enemy wasn't necessarily somebody that had a different political thought than I had. He wasn't necessarily somebody that had different political tactics than I had. The enemy was those people that were dropping bombs on the Indochinese, and my enemy was those people that united with the U.S. government to help, whether they were left-wing forces or right-wing forces, it didn't matter. And basically, that's the philosophy that I came back with, and that is that, you know, I'm not going to pacifist bait anymore. I'm not going to even liberal bait anymore. Well, that's going to be hard. I'm just going to try to work with people that basically support the Vietnamese in their struggle for sovereignty and independence and justice in their own land. And that basically is what we're talking about, and that's the independence of Vietnam, That's the right of those people to determine their own future, free of any imperialist power. And that means I support the 9 points, and I'll support anybody that supports the 9 points. Joan's been singing songs about the 9 points. That's all that matters anymore. And I think the movement's going to have to do some growing in recognizing what friends and what enemies are. That means being careful who they work with, as well as being careful who they attack. Well, you know, the reason that Nixon pulled out of Vietnam wasn't because he's a good man, I mean, as far as ground troops go. The reason he pulled out was, one, because of the American public, which was rising up, and two, because he'd lost the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps. Revolts were happening in the field. Units were refusing to fight. The GI movement was growing stronger, so he had to find some way else to fight the war. And then he discovered technology. But because the Vietnamese people were shooting down increasing numbers of B-52s, because the GI movement was getting stronger, he had to again look for something else, which I believe the peace treaty is. Pilots are definitely refusing to fly. A lot of people that work on the ground don't put the fuses in airplanes. You know, interesting story is that at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, people decided they didn't want planes to leave one day. So a group of mechanics went around and put the Ace of Spades, which is, you know, the card of death, on all the pilot seats, and all the pilots refused to fly that day. And there's a lot of things like that that are going on. I mean, you know, Nixon lost the Army and the Marine Corps. It looks like he's using the Air Force, so he'll probably have to try something else. The other thing that's important to note is that Nixon didn't bring the Vietnamese to their knees. He didn't force them to anything. The Vietnamese forced him. The government in the summer, the first day of the Democratic Convention, called a grand jury investigation, called 26 members of the leadership in the southern states of VVAW to the grand jury, claimed that they planned to disrupt the Democratic Convention and the Republican Convention. The charges have been changed. 10 people are indicted now? 8 people? 8 people are indicted now. But they changed the charges into, supposedly they were going to attack police stations with slingshots and fried marbles. And people that served in Vietnam as infantry people were going to attack people with automatic weapons, cannons, tanks with fried marbles. I believe it's very good, but, you know, the only proof that I had was that there was 2 members of the Pathet Lao staying in our hotel also, and they seem to be getting along well with the Vietnamese. If you're asking from personal experience, you know, I really can't say. If you're asking, you know, from things that I've read, they all work together. I mean, they have the basic goal, and that's freedom for each of their independent countries. The Cambodians? I believe the Cambodians have basically a 6-point plan, and the Laotians a 3-point plan, but it's embodied in the 9-point program. Even though that, like, the 7-point peace plan of the PRG is basically embodied in the 9-point program, and it's the same thing with their programs for peace. I don't know. We met with the PRG. There were Pathet Lao staying in our hotel. I couldn't speak Laotian. They couldn't speak English. And all we did was point at the sky when the planes came over and laugh and giggle together. You know, they gave me buttons and I gave them buttons. But as far as any real conversations, we didn't have any.
Chinese people, Chinese government, the Russian government, and people, I mean, in terms of supplies or attitude in Vietnam?
I don't have any idea. The only thing I know is when we went to visit the Chinese embassy, there was a fine photo of the chairman shaking hands with Ho Chi Minh. I don't know. I don't have the slightest idea. It wasn't discussed. It wasn't brought up. The only thing we talked about was the American movement and Vietnam. And we didn't talk about support, aid, or any other countries. I think it can best be summed up that in the Tet Offensive of 1968, there was 500,000 American troops in South Vietnam. There was 1 million puppet troop, ARVN troops. There was 50,000 Koreans. There was 50,000 Thais. There was 15,000 Australians. There was a couple of thousand Filipinos. There was a couple of thousand New Zealand troops. And according to military intelligence, our intelligence, the combined forces of the National Liberation Front and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam was 190,000. Those people moved the length and breadth of Vietnam without us knowing about it. Those people took over major cities. They outfought us. The only way they could have done it was with the direct aid of the people of that country. There's no way they could have fought the overwhelming firepower and the numerical superiority of the U.S. forces. Unless the people themselves supported them. And, you know, a lot of people come back and they say, the Vietnamese, you know, all they care about is eating their rice. They don't care about anything else. The basic reason Americans come back saying that is because the Vietnamese don't give a damn about the Americans, and as a consequence, there's no relationship between the Americans and the Vietnamese people themselves.
Gary, wouldn't you say that one of the basic reasons for the terrorism bombing racist attitudes of our government and how they view, how people in the government view the Vietnamese people as...
No. Well, see, basically, I don't think the U.S. government gives a damn about any people, whether they be American, whether they be the Vietnamese, whether they be Mozambique, whether they be Belgian. You know, I think basically that's what it comes down to. You know, they don't care whether they bomb POW compounds. They don't care whether they kill black people in the streets of America. They don't even care if they kill white students at Kent. The only thing that's important to them is that their policies carried out and that they retain their own power. I believe the reason that they had the mass bombings in Vietnam, the way they had the mass bombings, was because they were hoping to terrorize the Vietnamese people into submission. And it just totally failed. The last statement that the Vietnamese told us before we got on the plane was, you know, President Nixon's trying to pave the way to peace with bombs, but if he continues, the Vietnamese will pave the way to peace with downed B-52s. So. The only thing that they said was that once peace treaty was signed, the struggle was entering another phase and that it had to be implemented. And that was the only thing that came across on that. Jesus Christ, I don't know. Let's see. There's 1.5 million in the ARVN forces, so there's 1.5 million mercenaries. I don't know. But see, I don't necessarily believe that General Laval did secret bombings without the administration knowing about it. I mean, there's been scapegoats before, and I'm sure there'll be scapegoats in the future. I mean, Tu was the one that stopped the peace plans in October, right? President Nixon doesn't control him economically, politically, militarily. I doubt very much whether General Laval or any other general would go against the wishes of President Nixon. I doubt that very much. You don't have to worry about getting away with it. They get away with pretty much without even doing that. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's we're getting the total realm of conjecture there. I don't know.
What is the reaction to what you did in this country since you've been back? Especially, have you talked to any groups that might not be sympathetic for you?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of groups, especially newspaper people. I've been on television shows with, like, the chairman of the Conservative Party of New York and people, members of the right-wing POW group. People have lost total faith in the Nixon government. I mean, that's a reality. After just the stories alone on the Bakmai Hospital, you know, first it was Bakmai Airport, then it was a medical facility, but it wasn't a hospital. Then it was hit by, then it was a hospital, but it was hit by a SAM missile. And then, well, it was hit by maybe an accidental bombing. And then, no, it wasn't hit by an accidental bombing. A B-52 fell on it. And then, no, well, we really did bomb it, but it was surrounded by, you know, military targets. And people can't face that anymore. I mean, it's really coming down to where the people themselves don't place any trust in the Nixon administration. I mean, when a man like Saxby says that he thought the president lost his senses, you know, I've had two red-baiting questions since I've been back. It's the same question, but it's been asked twice, and that was, do you think you're being used by the communists for their propaganda purposes in Vietnam? And that's the only thing. It's the only red-baiting question I've been asked. Yeah. Okay, just two more, and then we'll end it. No, I don't. I don't think it will at all. I don't think people believe it. I really don't. And it's really important. I'm really happy with that. When we were in Vietnam, as I said, the Vietnamese keep very close track of the peace movement. And I think it was Christmas Day, one of the members of the committee took me aside and he says, what's going on? Why are the Americans so worried about the POWs? Why are they worried about those flyers instead of worrying about the children they're bombing? And how come when the bombing is so intense right now, why aren't people in the street? Why aren't people acting? Why aren't people marching? Why aren't people demonstrating? I couldn't answer him. And I hope that we'll show him on the 20th and in the future after the 20th that we're going to be in the streets. Okay, if I could just end it with one last statement, and that is, you know, coming from Vietnam Veterans Against the War. You know, like, all my brothers and sisters in Vietnam Vets Against the War went over to Vietnam, and they pulled the triggers, and they dropped the bombs. And they did the actual genocide. They did the actual ecocide. They removed people from their ancestral homes. They stole food. In other words, we were a bunch of gangster punks. But one thing that has to be remembered is, and that's that we were nothing more than the trigger finger for the American society. And it wouldn't have been allowed to happen if the American people, the American movement, had been moving more so that we would understand what's going on. And I guess what I'm saying is that everybody in this room has to share with the people that have been in Vietnam the guilt of what the U.S. government is doing in Vietnam. And the only way you can get away from that is to put yourself diametrically opposed to the power structure in Washington that is perpetrating those acts against the Vietnamese. And presently, there are people working 24 hours a day to foment racism, to kill Indo-Chinese people, to keep us down. And the only way that, like, we're going to defeat those people is for all of us to get together, all of us to start talking to ourselves and to other people, start relating to people as Americans. You know, if the Vietnamese can differentiate between the American government and the American people, I hope the American peace movement can do it. We've got to get down and we've got to start working 24 hours a day to end the problems in this country as well as the Vietnam War. And I guess that means people have to start deciding what their priorities are. And people have to start deciding whether that means they want another television or they want another car or they want a new set of clothes or whether they want that degree or whether they want this country changed around. And I certainly hope people decide on the proper priorities. Thank you.
What I have to do now is normally very difficult to do. but under the circumstances, it's difficult for a different reason. And that's it. I don't know what I can add. We're going to ask you for some money, both for the National VVAW and to help subsidize the transportation to Washington. I just don't know quite what I can add beyond what Barry said. He makes it very easy to give. So, Tony, do you have the people who are going to collect the money?